exercise mind and body with RN.
G'day, Cameron Wilson joining you. You're listening to Bush Telegraph on RN and Radio Australia. Today, where you get ripped off at the petrol pump, the study that finds country motorists are paying too much for fuel, and we find out how the grey nomads dodge the expense. Also ahead, what does a master tea blender make of Billy tea?
Some of the fundamentals of, enjoying a good cup of Billy tea is, buy good tea and store it well, and then use good quality water. This is very, very important. Water is the mother of tea.
Karush Barucha tastes 1,000 cups of tea a day. So we share his thoughts on Australian tea later today on Bush Telegraph. One of the country's biggest horse culls has just been completed in the north of Western Australia, where more than 7,000 Brumbies have been shot from helicopters because they're causing serious environmental damage. There's been limited public opposition to the cull, which begs the question, why is it okay to shoot 7,000 wild horses in an isolated area where the same decision would cause uproar in more heavily populated parts of the eastern states? To find out more about the cull at Lake Gregory in WA's north, we're joined by author Kim Mahood, who's written a book about the region called Desert Lake. It was published by CSIRO. Kim, welcome to Bush Telegraph. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Cameron. Hi.
What are the environmental reasons for a cull like this?
Well, first of all, you've got to understand the place itself, which is one of the most significant arid zone wetlands in the Southern Hemisphere. And partly it's so remote is why this isn't generally known. The horse issue has been around for a very long time. It is an Indigenous protected area and a pastoral lease, which is a complicated situation from the start. But back in 2000, when the scoping survey was done for the Indigenous protected area application, the horse issue was identified back then as potentially one of the biggest environmental issues. You've got that many horses on the grasslands around, a big waterway. You're going to get a huge environmental impact.
And they're doing damage.
Of course.
What's the area actually look like, though? What do you see when you go there?
It depends which bit you go to, really. Southeast Kimberley, it's mostly pretty flat country. The lake itself is the terminus of Sturt Creek, so it sort of comes down through... You've got Spinifex country, you've got grasslands, and then, it's actually blocked by the beginning of the Great Sandy Desert, these sort of ancient dune systems. So you have this amazing kind of inland sea at the top of the Great Sandy Desert.
So how come the horses have done so well there?
Well, the area was the sort of the end of the pastoral country. It was established, Billalona itself was established around about the turn of, in about 1900. And the lake was central to the, it provided the grasslands and the water for the cattle. Over the next 70-odd years, horses were used initially for stock work. A very good line of horses was established, Arab and Thoroughbred cross, so, they are beautiful-looking horses. Then when the stations were purchased for the traditional owners, the Wamadjari, in 1978, from then on, the horse issue began to sort of develop, and by probably the 1990s, it was starting to get out of control. Mm.
And controlling the horses, I know, is critical to what happens with the future of this land and the pastoral lease.
We'll talk about that
in a moment. But the Aboriginal Land Trust were in charge of the cull, and our colleagues at the country, the ABC Country Hour in WA, spoke to the chair there. I'd be interested to hear what you think of what Clinton Wolfe had to say.
It's been a very emotional and complex issue. And when I got there, there's a number of people there that, I've got a relationship with in terms of, their family to me. And when they come up to me and they're distressed and saying, you need to help us and, it's ridiculous and we're trying to, get on top of this and, we're trying to get infrastructure in and, we build a fence one day and the next day it's not there because a herd of wild horses is running right through the middle of it. Yeah, you can see the distress in their eyes, and they've had a connection, with these horses for 100, 120 years, Now, sure, we want a few horses out here because we want to maintain that connection, but, you know, you can't have 6,000-7,000 horses running around. And what was concerning them also is that when there was no water around, horses were coming into the community, and, you know, you've got 2-3-year-old kids walking around, and, you know, you're not saying, you know, a wild horse is aggressive or anything like that, but you've got a wild animal that, you know, suddenly takes fright over, you know, a vehicle going past and takes off and runs over the top of a child. I mean, is anybody going to turn around and say, oh, you know, well, we should put up with that? You know, we want to have these stations up to scratch. So when the pastoral lands boards come around, they say, no, you're not in breach anymore. Well done.
That's Clinton Wolfe, Chair of the Aboriginal Lands Trust in WA, speaking to our colleague Belinda Vereschetti. My guest is Kim Mahood, who's the author of a book called Desert Lake, published by the CSIRO, and we're discussing the extensive, the massive, really, Brumby Cull that's taken place in the north of WA over the past week or so. Kim, why is the pastoral lease at risk if the horses aren't culled?
Okay, so they're 99-year leases. They're due to come up for renewal in 2015, which is now 2 years, it's just over a year away. And in about 2008, people came to me. I was working out there at the time. They'd been getting messages from the pastoral lands board saying that the horses, if something wasn't done about them, then, you know, there was a risk of the leases being withdrawn when they came up again. Mainly at that point, it was a pastoral issue that with that number of horses, it couldn't possibly be functioning effectively as a cattle station. At the same time, the Aboriginal Lands Trust were trying to divest the leases back to the traditional owners. So there's a complex, structure of management and so on. And that was when the traditional owners came to me and said, what does this imply? What it did imply was that they would then be left with the issue of dealing with the horses. So since that time, which is now 7 years ago, or 6 years ago, this has been ongoing, you know, a discussion with the ALT, with the Pastoral Lands Trust, with the traditional owners, with the Indigenous Protected Area, Department of the Environment, you know, all of those, DEC in WA, all of those groups have been attempting together to solve this problem. So I'm astonished and really, you know, pleased that it's finally happened. Because without it, the Indigenous, the owners can't go anywhere. You know, nothing can happen in terms of their environmental sort of requirements to hold their Indigenous protected area, apart from the pastoral lease issue as well.
Okay. Look, we've said how it's happened in WA. It's control of wild horses in this fashion, aerial culling, is essentially off the table in Victoria, for instance, where it's a problem in the high country. But it's also carried out this type of control in the Northern Territory as well. So I want to talk more about why you think it's been able to take place in WA soon. But let's go across the border now into the Northern Territory where, well, they're no strangers, are they, to wild horse culls. On the phone is Alaric Fisher from the Government Department Land Resource Management. Alaric, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning, Cameron.
How bad's the feral horse problem in the Northern Territory?
Oh, well, it's patchily very bad. I mean, there's a lot of feral animals across the landscape. The landscape's suffering from a whole lot of ferals, horses amongst them, camels, donkeys, buffalo, feral cattle in some places. And on some properties, like we've just heard in WA, you get the horses are basically out of control through, lack of any systematic management. And so you get huge numbers, huge densities.
Mm. And so how does an aerial cull work in the Northern Territory? What's the process?
Well, look, we've had a lot of experience of aerial culls over the past few years, particularly through the management of feral camels. There's been a very large national program for managing feral camels. And we've taken those techniques and applied them to horses as well when we're asked to do so by the landowners. So there's some stringent standard operating procedures, but generally you'd have helicopters with certified shooters in them, usually a couple of helicopters, two or three helicopters operating together. They'd fly transects or over an area that was being managed. There's some requirements in terms of when they encounter animals. It's an absolute requirement that each animal shot twice, a minimum of twice. And then at the end of that line or at the end of the group of animals, they fly back over it to ensure that they're all dead.
So they have to. That's the reason for the two shots, to make sure that you.
That's right, and so there's a very stringent requirement there, and in the case of the camel program, for example, that's then often audited by a vet who comes along and inspects the. So the location of every shot animal is GPSed, and they're inspected subsequently by a vet, and the welfare outcomes are audited.
So the point is, though, you treat wild horses the same, in a management sense, you treat them the same as any other feral animal.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's exactly right. There's nothing special about horses in terms of you know, a feral animal doing damage to the landscape.
Hmm. Is it controversial, aerial culling in the Northern Territory?
Look, I mean, there's always some controversy. The local controversy is usually around utility, whether we'd be better off, or whether the animals would be better off, you know, mustered and sold or used for pet meat or the like.
Mm.
The controversy about animal welfare generally comes externally, usually from Southern Australia or even internationally.
Why can't they be mustered or sold?
There's no bar to people doing that, and of course if they can do that economically, that's encouraged. But we're talking a landscape scale problem. Or an issue. And I think that's one of the problems people from elsewhere don't really have that perspective, that we're talking usually tens of thousands of animals over tens or even hundreds of thousands of square kilometres of often rugged and almost always inaccessible country. Mm. And, you know, you could manage small parts of that through mustering and pet meeting. But much of it you have to do by another technique, and aerial culling has been shown to be both. The science is very clear, I think, on this, both the most humane and the most cost effective method.
Kim Mahood, you were nodding there when Alaric said the opposition tends to come from the south of Australia.
Yes, although actually up at Lake Gregory, there's a very organised. Group based in Broome that activates an international sort of reaction. Mm. And that is what I think halted an attempted cull 3 years ago. So, yes, there's this incredibly sentimental attachment to horses that isn't usually sort of exercised with other types of feral animals, I think.
And there's criticism of this latest cull.
If you followed ABC
News, you'd see the pictures that are out at the moment, and criticism that about 1% of the horses weren't killed in the fashion that Alaric described there.
Yeah. Look, you know, I guess when you've got that sort of number, you're going to have issues like that. But what I think isn't being put out is that it's probably just in time to avert another kind of animal welfare issue, which is that the lake is lower than it's been in, you know, 10 years. It's becoming very salty, which means the horses are either, you know, poisoned by the salts, or they move off to the handful of much smaller freshwater pools along Sturt Creek, and at which point, you know, they start getting bogged and perishing in the waterways or starving. So it was 40 degrees when I was out there in September. You know, temperatures in the summer are 50 plus consistently, and you get that sort of heat and evaporation with, you know, and a low wet season. So that's what was coming up, and I think that's one of the reasons probably that this cull did go ahead, was that it just circumvented a much worse situation.
Alaric, is the motivation for the cull in the Northern Territory sometimes the welfare of the wild horses as well, or is it predominantly for environmental reasons?
Look, that's certainly part of the issue, and just backing up what Kim said, I mean, we've got photos from the desert, some of these areas where we have done culls of, you know, desert waterholes, which are an incredibly precious resource in that landscape, that are just packed to the brim with dead horses in dry times. So, yes, there's certainly a very serious animal welfare issue, but ultimately the thing we should be most concerned about is the impact of these animals on the landscape as a whole, and on every other species that uses that landscape, and the need to control them across that landscape.
Alaric, do you think aerial culling of horses is something that can or will ever be used in the southern and eastern states, where there is a higher human population that is concerned about this?
Oh, look, I hope so. I mean, I hope so, and I hope that some of the really solid scientific data that, for example, we've been able to collect through our work that actually gives figures for the humaneness, if you like, the animal welfare standards that you can achieve in terms of, for example, in the most recent horse cull that we did, that was supervised by vets, also flying in helicopters behind the shooters, that no animals were wounded and left alive, and that the time to death that they measured, the average time to death was something like 8 seconds. So I'd like to read you out a sentence from the vet's report, which mm-hmm. I think sums up the issue. While not aesthetically pleasing, the technique of helicopter shooting for feral horses allows a far shorter duration of suffering when compared to any other methods proposed to manage populations. So I think that's the balance. It doesn't look good, and so it's very easy for people to post photos on Facebook and to create a public reaction, but the science and the data supports that it's actually a very effective and relatively humane approach.
Now, Kim, you grew up in the Kimberley but now live in Canberra, so you're familiar with the East and the West, the Northwest approach to the debate. How do you describe the differences?
Oh, look, I just think there's a much greater critical mass in the South that doesn't actually have any first-hand experience or connection to you know, the land and the issues of environmental management. So you have that sort of very understandable emotional sentiment that is raised, and you just have the numbers down here. You know, I grew up in the bush. The numbers were always in the South, you know.
Yeah. So that's where a lot of the decisions end up being made, I guess.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, thank you for coming in today, Kim. Really nice to get your insights. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Kim Mahood, who's written a book called Desert Lake that was published by the CSIRO. And Alaric, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, very welcome, Cameron.
Alaric Fisher, Executive Director of Flora and Fauna at the Department of Land Resource Management in the Northern Territory. Now, in light of this cull in WA, we asked the Victorian Government for the latest on its plans to control wild horses in alpine areas. Now, it says aerial culls are not an option, but didn't want to be interviewed by Bush Telegraph. In a statement, the government says it's focusing on other control measures, including the live removal or rehoming of horses and the euthanasia of captured horses in a controlled environment. Doesn't say exactly what the controlled environment constitutes. The RSPCA has accused the government of placing more importance on public perception than on animal welfare. It says, it's a quote, Parks Victoria, prematurely ruling out shooting will make it all the more difficult to now convince the public of the relative humaneness of it and have adverse welfare impacts on the horses themselves. If you've got a view, you can go to the Bush Telegraph Facebook page and share your thoughts with us there. You're listening to Bush Telly on RN. For the latest rural news today, I'm joined by Kath McAleen. How are you, Kath?
Good, thanks, Cam.
Yesterday afternoon was just a little too late for our program, unfortunately. We heard an announcement around the government's, it's not drought policy, but drought funding, I guess you'd say. What's the reaction been to that?
Yeah, so that's right. The Federal Agriculture Minister, Barnaby Joyce, announced changes to their farm finance debt relief package, as it's called, which will see more funding directed to Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria. But it comes at the expense of other states and the Northern Territory. So Barnaby Joyce says Queensland will get an extra $20 million for concessional loans this financial year. New South Wales and Victoria will each get an additional $10 million. He says the worsening drought in Queensland in particular means that state is the focus of this new money. And it's all because mm-hmm. Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria are the only state so far to sign up to that farm finance program. So there is money for the other states once they get on board. And Mr. Joyce has confirmed that some of that money, $10 million, will be coming from unallocated funds that were originally destined for sustainable agriculture projects under the Caring for Our Country and Land Care programs. He's also announced that the Commonwealth will give Queensland an additional $7 million for water infrastructure, so for constructing bores and watering points on drought-affected properties. It has been welcomed in Queensland. The farm lobby group AgForce says that it's a positive first step. Their CEO, Charles Burke, says he's happy that it recognises that Queensland is one of the state's worst affected affected by drought at the moment. But as to whether it will be enough in the long term, he says that's hard to know.
The issue with this is we don't know the impact of this drought and how long it will last. So we are still yet grappling with the concept of what sort of initiatives we need. This is a good initial response. It's a positive response and it is a reasonable response.
Okay. Now, the opposite of drought, I guess, is the plans that are happening in on the table, at least for Northern Australia. The fact that there's so much water that could be harnessed in Australia's north, which is why the federal government's interested in looking at developing agriculture there. There's been another assessment of just how viable that is. What's it found?
Yeah, that's right. Well, the Regional Australia Institute has completed a report into opportunities to in that area, and it says that there's an opportunity there to export tropical knowledge and services to Asia. So sort of looking at what we can learn in that part and also export it overseas. The report does point out, though, a couple of stumbling blocks, I guess, and that's a lack of infrastructure and a lack of workers in the top end. The Institute Chief Executive Sue McCluskey says there needs to be a more sophisticated approach to development.
You know, there's a real opportunity to really further develop, you know, things such as tropical knowledge and services that go with that. The ability to really be able to leverage that and look at the export of those services to Asia and also more broadly the world is a great opportunity.
Okay, we'll hear more about the developing the north, no doubt. There's been lots of talk about Warrnambool cheese and butter and all the potential buyers of that dairy company, but while all the focus has been on WCB, there's been another dairy company sold.
Yeah, that's right. The Tamar Valley Dairy, which is in Tasmania, was bought yesterday by big dairy company Fonterra. The Tamar Valley Dairy's been in a bit of trouble. It went into voluntary administration 6 weeks ago. It was trying to sort of transition from a small factory to a much bigger manufacturing site and accrued some big debts and went into administration. So Fonterra bought it up yesterday, and Fonterra Australia's Managing Director Judith Swales says that it will complement their existing yogurt business at Echuca in Victoria, and she says that Fonterra will acquire Tamar's site and equipment as well as its brands and intellectual property.
It's currently doing around 10,000 tonnes. It's a $1.6 billion category, and it's a category that's growing. It's growing more than most of the categories in the dairy space, so it's a good category to be investing behind.
Everyone's interested in investing in dairy at the moment, aren't they?
Dairy's in the spotlight, that's for sure.
All right, thanks, Kath.
Thanks, Cam.
Kath McLoon with the latest in rural news. Also in the news a bit at the moment is the cost of fuel. City motorists from Perth to Brisbane are used to the fuel cycle, the curious way that pump prices are lowest midweek and gradually rise to a peak on about Friday. But regional drivers, well, apparently get it even worse. The University of New England has made a list of 28 places where motorists are most likely to be ripped off at the pump, and they're all in the country. Professor Abbas Valikani from UNE Business School looked at 11 regional locations over a five-year period. Abbas, thank you for joining us today.
Good morning.
How come you did this study? What prompted it?
Actually, I wrote a paper back in 2010. I looked at the asymmetric pricing behavior of unleaded, the price of unleaded petrol. And I discovered that there is some evidence of asymmetric pricing. And then I applied for a discovery project, the government-funded project, and I wanted to look at the specific location. So I purchased data from FuelTrack and Informed Sources. Both of them, they are very reputable major companies based in Brisbane. They survey and they collect daily data from individual petrol stations and they aggregate the data. So anyway, I purchased data and I put them together and then I realized that I need time series data. I need to look at if I could see any discernible pattern in the price of unleaded petrol. And I happen to have 111 locations across Australia that I could compile this database from 29th of October 2007 up to end of January 2012, which basically is around 223 weeks of data.
Yeah, so quite a lot. And you came up with 28 places where motorists are being ripped off. What constitutes being ripped off?
Okay. As you indicated, there are 111 locations in total. 28 of them could be described as rocket and feeder pricing.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, 75% of all locations are doing the right thing,
yeah.
And only 25% of them, these 28 locations. And what happened is we are dealing with two different type of speed. If the price of crude oil or if the price of wholesale price, if wholesale price of petrol goes up or if the crude oil, crude oil prices go up or if exchange rate depreciates or Singapore petrol price go up, for any of these reasons, price of petrol shoots up like a rocket. So that's one particular speed. And the second type of speed of adjustment is when the opposite happens, when the crude oil prices goes down or wholesale price of petrol goes down or exchange rate appreciates. This time, the prices goes down like a feather. That's why we call this phenomenon rocket and feather hypothesis.
Yeah.
So we did not, for example, we did not witness this, in other words, the speed of when the prices go up compared to when the speed go when the prices goes down. When we compare these two speeds in Adelaide, we don't see any significant difference. But in these 28 differences, we have two totally different speed of adjustment, which we described as asymmetric behavior.
Okay, so we're talking here about petrol, not diesel. So it's not a lot of farmers that are affected in this instance. But look, the people that among the people that are affected, I guess, are your campervanners and your grey nomads. Chairman of the Campervan and Motorhome Club of Australia, Vincent Moran, is on the line from a caravan park on the Gold Coast. How are you, Vincent?
Very well, thank you.
I imagine you would be familiar with the rocket and feather phenomenon described there, expensive petrol.
Yes, we are very familiar. Probably more so diesel than petrol.
Okay.
I would think most of us, the greater majority would use diesel rather than petrol, but the patterns follow.
Yeah, okay. But your groups would be familiar with the places that are charging more fuel. You'd share the word around over two ways and the like, wouldn't you?
Well, let me put it this way. We've got about 30,000 vehicles in our club on the road. They all have two-way radios and they communicate. as a friend of mine once said, this is a better network than the CIA.
The Grey Nomad Network. I think we might have lost Vincent there. I've still got the professor with us, Professor Abbas. How do you fix this, Professor?
Okay, I can provide a little bit of more evidence. When we look at this 111 location, none of them are from Western Australia. And then we wonder why none of these locations are from Western Australia. There were eight of them from Western Australia, but none of them exhibited this behavior. And then we also looked at the South Australia. Out of 10 locations, only one of them exhibited this behavior. In other words, Western Australia becomes the cleanest state with no evidence of asymmetric pricing. And then we looked at what could possibly explain this phenomenon. We realized that they have a fuel watch, which is a government initiative, Western Australian government initiative. And what happened is, according to that initiative, all petrol stations must declare and upload their retail prices on that website, and they are locked in for the next 24 hours. In other words, they cannot change the prices, and motorists know what the prices are for the next 24 hours. They shop around, and that encourages competitions among the petrol stations. So that's one way of, maybe that explains why there's a bit of competition.
Maybe something for the other states to consider. Professor, thank you for joining us today. Nice to chat with you.
No worries.
Professor Abbas Vallecani from the UNE Business School, who, as he told us, looked at 111 regional locations and the price of fuel. Also, thank you to Vincent Moran, who's the chairman of the Campervan and Motorhome Club. I think he took off to the beach at the Gold Coast or something. We haven't got him again. But anyway, thanks for joining us on Bush Telly. You're on RN and Radio Australia.
There is a racist atmosphere in France in this moment.
The Roma drifting west across Europe in search of a better life are meeting fierce resistance.
It is getting harder and harder because of the politics and because of the media.
Come with us to France to see what kind of life they've found.
What I can say is that here at least we are not hungry.
That's the new Untouchables, 360 documentaries in Paris this Sunday after the news at 10.
Mike McCarthy can be pretty hard to pin down when he's not surfing. He's taking his blend of blues and folk inspired by stories of the sea to the capital cities and regional Australia and overseas quite often as well. We've managed to lure him in, though, to the Bush Telly studios today for a chat and a couple of songs. Mike, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Cameron.
Now, I know you've got a new release coming out very soon and you've been on the road. I want to talk all about that in a moment. But should we kick off with a song? Can you play something for us?
Most certainly. This is a song called December, and it's off the new album called Lion's Share.
Got lost in December, never found my way. I just can't remember who I am today. It's taken a long time. Feel again, holding out for something, bidding for a sign. Nature has its own way of playing with the light. It's taken a long time to feel again. A body, it's broken, but I'm the man. To find you is golden, and to know you is best. Oh, I cannot see you, oh, but I love you nonetheless. Left you with some pieces, fragments of myself. Do you still have them with you? Are they up upon your shelf? It's taken a long time. Feel again. That body, it's twisted, but I'm on the mend. To find you is golden, and to know you is best. Oh, I cannot see you, oh, but I love you nonetheless.
Mike McCarthy with December, live in the RN studios. Mike, that's off the album The Lion's Share, which is, what, a year or so ago now?
Yeah, about a year and probably 3 months ago.
Yeah, what have you been up to since then?
Well, I got married. That was one thing. So, right after I recorded the album, I got married. So that was a great, good timing that was.
Yeah, yeah.
And my poor wife, Sophie, got a first-hand taste of what it's like to be married to a musician. And
which she had a rough idea what that was like already.
I think she did.
Yeah.
And, thankfully, she's a great singer. So she came on the road with me and we've been touring around. She's a singer and piano player. And so, yeah, we've been doing some gigs out west to Canoundra and up the north coast. We've been up to Tweed Heads and Noosa and, doing a bunch of travelling and just playing to good people who want to come out and listen to music.
It's good. Spend your honeymoon on the road, hey?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we went to New Zealand for a short trip, a very short trip, and then we came back and got straight into touring.
Because you've spent so much time on the road, I know, for the last decade or more, and you pretty much go anywhere, really, won't you? You'll play the small towns as well as the big cities.
Yeah, look, I'm available for anything. Just about. I've played in Japan at small little chicken shops and in on big festival stages, and I've come back to Australia and I've played, chicken shops here in Torquay and all sorts,
How do you end up playing a chicken shop in Japan?
I have no idea, but they said, look, you've got to come to this chicken shop, and I had my guitar with me, and we ate every single part of the chicken. And
the feet.
Ate the feet, used the little bits on the end to clean the teeth at the end, and they brought out some raw horse for me, which was a treat. That was something I'd never experienced before, and I was waiting for them to bring out my little barbecue to cook it on.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, you eat now, and I was like, oh, okay, sure.
So you did?
So I did. And they said I have the strength of a shogun sort of warrior now, so there you go.
the places your music will take you, hey?
That's right.
It's amazing where you have a following. Now, you spend a lot of time in Australia, but you do get to, not just Japan, you get overseas a bit, don't you? And it's often the surfing movement that embraces your music.
That's right. Yeah, it was a strange thing that one of my friends, he's a very good filmmaker, his name's Nathan Oldfield, and I did some music for his first film and subsequently all the rest of his films. And they were doing well in Japan and Italy and in America, all parts of Europe and, some really interesting places, a lot of which I haven't been to visit yet, but I do plan on it. I've been to America and Britain, and both places, I've been in the Midwest and guys have sort of said, I love your music on that surf film, mate. It's what?
That's long way from the ocean, but they like the film.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah. Like, it's the way that he connects, he really captures the land and has a great eye for seeing how, beauty in quite common things that we think are quite common here in Australia, just beautiful.
Mm. Your music, it is often inspired by not just tales of journey, but in particular the sea and the ocean, really, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, I've always had a real connection with the ocean from when I was a little kid. One of my best friends drowned when I was 4 years old in the sea near where I live, and it was such a sad thing. But at the same time, I think I've grown to have such a healthy appreciation of how powerful the ocean can be, but also how beautiful it can be. And I grew up surfing on the Central Coast, a lot of that to combat some of those fears of how dangerous the ocean can be. And I've had a really great lifestyle growing up surfing and being just in the water constantly. I just love going down for a swim at the beach. Yeah. It's a wonderful pastime for us.
So when do you write? Is it when you're out? Do you think of a song when you're out surfing or when you're sitting by the beach or when you're at home?
Quite often, yeah. Quite often when I'm surfing or if I'm driving back from a gig or something, it's usually something that's been stewing or brewing over a long period of time, and all of a sudden it comes. There'll just come a line or a melody or something in those quiet times when I do have a bit of space to myself, usually after a lot of chaos, actually.
Yeah, just sit down and it starts to make sense.
Once it's been really crazy and then I just find a quiet place.
Yeah, which is what you're entering now, isn't it? You've had this crazy time on the road and I think it's a couple more gigs in December and then you've got some quiet time?
That's right, yeah. I get to get my wisdom teeth out that time. So that's going to be wonderful for some songwriting.
Not so good for the singing, eh?
Well, let's hope I get some of those central nerves back or something.
So what have you got planned for release-wise in December? Because as we said earlier, it's been a little while since The Lion's Share came out.
Yeah, so I'll be releasing a compilation album. It's a compilation of a bunch of songs that I've recorded for surf films over the years. One's an Alaskan surf film that's coming out soon. And so there you go. There's another place that's weird. You would never think there's surf
in
Alaska.
You'd want a thick wetsuit.
No, yeah, you certainly would. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm releasing this album. It's called Seaside. And I'll be releasing that at the start of December.
Okay. Well, so that's one to look forward to. Now, before we let you go, I want to get another track if we can. But can we go to something a little bit older?
Sure.
The album, before you play, just tell us a bit about the story of the album, The Harrowing Account of John William Tade. It's a couple of years back now, about 5 years ago, I think.
Yes. It's a long-winded title. And it was basically a story that I came up with. At the start, I didn't tell anyone that I came up with. I wanted to see how many people I could fool. And so, The Harrowing Account of John William Tade kind of came about from I'd been in England and touring around there, and I'd been to Greenwich and seen the Cutty Sark, an old tea ship over there, and it got me thinking about sailors and just the amazing adventures of ocean travel and that sort of thing. And I started to formulate this story, and I was writing letters as if I was this person called John William Tate, and I was writing about his friends and all this sort of stuff, and I was formulating this little story. And basically it's about he was a farmer. And he was growing cotton out there and decided one day that he had all these grand dreams of going to the sea. He'd never been seen the ocean, he'd never seen water. And so this was his big getaway to go and find the ocean and become a captain of a boat. And this was a huge dream of his. And so, yeah, the story is really about almost the coming of age of a man too, taking the reins as a man and being man of your destiny.
And this story formed a concept album, basically, and it is a fictional character, we can be certain
about
that.
Yes, I can release that to the world now.
All right, well, let's say, can we get the track, John William Tate, from the album?
Yes, that'd be great.
All right, you're listening to Bush Telly on RN. This is Mike McCarthy, the track, John William Tate.
Hard to see there's a ship of cargo and ballast, with men gone adrift or hungry and callous. The heat of the day and such salt thick air, and bringing them down to the pit of despair. Ooh, now the patience takes such a weight is all in the hands of one John William Tate. To my darling one, I shudder to think our 7 more days may bring us to sink, and I feel that my heart, it is finally lifted. All the lay of the land, and matter one holding me here. Ooh, now the patience it takes to captain such a weight is all in the hands of one John William Tate. Now the patience it takes to captain such a weight, all in the hands of one John William Tate. In the still of the night, I wake to a tune, a melody pretty and a melody so true. Ah, for years I have searched, and finally this. Oh, my lovely one, the lay of the land, it holds me here. Now the patience it takes to captain such a weight is all in the hands of one John William Tate. Ooh, now the patience it takes I'd have kept in such a weight. It's all in the hands of one John William Tate. It's all in the hands of one John William Tate.
The track's John William Tate, Mike McCarthy playing live in the Bush Tally studio on RN. Mike, good luck with the release of the album next month, and all the best with the wisdom teeth. Hope they come out nice and easy for you.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
You're listening to RN. This is Bush Tally. Let's turn our attention to tea now, if you're having a morning cuppa. Did you know that after water, tea is actually the most popular drink in the world? There's a lot that goes into making a perfect brew. Karush Barucha knows all about that. He tastes up to 1,000 cups of tea a day. That's in his role as a master blender with Lipton. He told me the job of taster is a lot like that of a wine expert.
It's a bit like wine tasting, Cameron. So we evaluate the sensorials of the product. So typically we would sort of categorize it across, you know, all the attributes of an agricultural product. So we map its flavor profile, we look at the color of the tea, we look at, you know, what the in-mouth sensation is, what's the mouth feel, what's the astringency, and so on. And we also look at the leaf itself, you know, is it ideal for a tea bag, or is it something that sits in a packet tea, as many countries drink it? So we look at the leaf and we look at the actual brew.
Does it involve a lot of sensory training to get to that stage? I know people think of wine tasting as, many people would think of it as, you know, just an enjoyable way to pass a weekend, but it actually is quite highly specialised and highly trained and quite exhausting to be part of.
That's right. So this it's very much like wine tasting. It's a craft skill, Cameron. So you have to sort of start early, and the more you do, the better you get. So it's something you have to practice. You start early as an apprentice under the guidance of a senior, and essentially you taste a lot of teas and begin to develop a palate memory. And you begin to understand, you know, the various nuances and subtleties of the various flavors from the different countries all over the world.
So you can pretty much identify the country that most teas have come from, can you?
That's right. We would be able to, yes.
Yeah? How did you actually get started? What's your background?
So I got into this almost by accident. So I became a tea taster by accident. It's not something that you can actually plan a career for, as you'd understand. It's not a place, you know, you can't go to a degree, a university, and shop for a, you know, degree in tea tasting. So you literally just stumbled into it, and that's what happened to me. I joined a tea company in India, you know, a long time ago, and that happened to be the Brooke Bond and Lipton companies, which were successful sort of international companies in their own right, and that's how I started 30 years back.
Did you grow up in some of those northern, more rural parts of India?
So I'm from India. I was born and brought up in Bombay, which is an urban city. But having said that, yes, I've spent time in the northern part of the country, the southern part of the country, which is where all the tea plantations in India, you know, originate from. So I'm sort of widely traveled, and I've grown up in a culture where tea is almost, you know, is second to water as it is globally.
Does the agricultural practices and some of the intervention that comes in along the way affect the flavour as well? It must surely, as in addition to the tea.
That's right. So I think the way it's grown is critically important. the quality starts with the bush. So the way you handle the tea plantation, the agronomics is very, very important. You need to start off with the right raw material. So, you know, it's very important to have plantations which are responsible, which cultivate tea in a way which is sustainable over the longer term for the long haul.
Mm. So the tea plantations themselves, are there many species of the plant?
Essentially, all teas, Cameron, come from what we call Camellia sinensis. That's the botanical name for the tea bush. It's called Camellia sinensis. Mm. And all teas that are made, whether it's black tea, green tea, oolong tea, all teas essentially are coming from this same bush. The differences in these teas is simply in the way that the teas are sort of processed after they are picked, and that's what results in different qualities of, you know, color differences and flavor differences. But essentially, it all comes from one bush, and that's what's really amazing about it, that you get such a lot of diversity at the end product. But it all stems from a single plant.
It's all
and a
the
single
same
raw
plant.
Material.
That's incredible, right. Really. I was imagining there'd be some kind of, you know, tea bush plant breeding center somewhere that comes up with various strains that are suited to climates and, you know, have flavor characteristics, but clearly not the case.
Yes, so there is a lot of engineering that goes on. So you have strains of bushes which are cultivated and perfected for being drought resistant or being sort of pest resistant and so on. But yes, essentially in terms of the raw material and the bush, it all stems from Camellia sinensis.
I know Australia's industry when it comes to the growing side of things is actually quite small, some in Queensland and some in northern New South Wales. But from your point of view, is that an area, from what you know about it, that is suited, should be suited to growing tea?
It would be difficult because Australia is as you understand, quite south of the Tropic of Capricorn. So ideally, you want something that grows closer to the equator because then you don't have any seasonality and the tea bush will grow 12 months of the year. As soon as you start moving north or south of the equator, then you have, a skewed growing season, which then always makes it difficult for the crop to be commercially viable. So, for example, if you look at tea from Assam or Darjeeling, which are in northern India, they are quite north of the equator, and as a result, there's a huge skew in terms of the availability, the quality, of these teas. Yeah.
So, do you have your doubts as to whether Australia could really ever compete with countries closer to the equator when it comes to growing quality tea?
It would be difficult, I think, for Australia. The northernmost parts of Australia could have a stab at it. So there is tea which grows in Indonesia. It then comes down to, Vietnam, Indonesia, Papua New Guinea used to grow some tea. I think if it has to grow in Australia, it can only be in the sort of northernmost parts where, the conditions of, it's like a more tropical climate. And that's probably where you stand the best chance.
My guest on Bush Telegraph is Karush Barucha, who is a master tea blender with Lipton, usually based in Dubai, but in Australia at the moment. Karusha, with what you know about tea drinking in Australia, it's popular here, as it is in many parts of the world. Are there any particular cultural tea drinking practices that are unique to Australia?
I think Australians have always had their tea with milk. So again, in many parts of the world, tea is drunk without milk. But Australia has taken off from, what the British habit of drinking tea with milk goes. So that's, I think, a mainstream preference. Mm. Having said that, consumers are now, a lot more aware and they're beginning to experiment with a lot more, flavored varieties and green teas, which are, I think, slowly catching on.
Have you ever tried Billy tea?
I have tried Billy tea. So that's akin to a tea which is known as Lapsang Souchong. I'm not sure if people might be familiar with that term. So there's a tea which comes from China. It's called Lapsang Souchong, and it's essentially got a sort of a smoky and a burnt character. And Billy tea also is an Australian specific variant, which mimics that sort of a taste because it's probably made in the outback, on a simple sort of a vessel on, which is heated and sort of boiled and brewed. So it has a taste reminiscent of a sort of a slightly smoky, burnt character.
Yeah.
So yes, I have heard of Billy tea.
Yeah. You'll hear a lot of debate amongst people when it comes to Billy tea as to the best method. Obviously, you boil a billy and then chuck the and then put the tea leaves in. But the swing around the head to make the tea leaves sink to the bottom of the brew, is that an appropriate technique, or do you risk doing some kind of damage to your tea by doing that?
No, I don't think it's particularly harmful as such. I think the most important thing to enjoy your billy tea is, use good quality water. I think that's something that people often don't realize. So some of the fundamentals of, enjoying a good cup of billy tea is, buy good tea and store it well, and then use good quality water. This is very, very important. Water is the mother of tea, and no matter what tea you drink, you need to have, fresh water, which is full of oxygen, which allows the tea to give off its flavor, to the maximum.
So just like drinking wine, get some oxygen in there to bring out the flavor, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you for chatting with the program today. Been really interesting.
Thanks, Cameron. Thanks very much.
Karush Barucha, who's a master tea blender, who was recently in Australia. So there you go. World tea expert, originally from India, based in Dubai, giving you some advice on how best to make and enjoy billy tea. All sorts of stuff you get on Bush Telly, hey? Tomorrow on the program, this has been promised for some time, but it will definitely happen tomorrow. We're going to reveal, it's an exclusive for Bush Telly, we're going to reveal Australia's favourite bird after the BirdLife Australia poll that was being run all through October. That was to determine which of a list of 52 birds is the nation's favourite. The results are now in, and tomorrow on the program we will let you know who won and also who's on the bottom, who came second and who rounds out the top five and all the rest as well. So make sure you join us for that. In the meantime, keep an eye on our website, the RN Bush Telly website. Also find us on Twitter @RNBushTelly or on Facebook. I'll see you at the same time tomorrow. You're on RN.
the women of the revolution. In Egypt, it was the video blog of one young woman that called thousands to protest in Tahrir Square. But when the revolution was done, women were dispatched to the bottom of the ticket in the first election. And on the streets of Los Angeles, a feisty nun fights for immigrants and the poor. Download or stream the Religion and Ethics Report from the RN website.